Nobody would buy a soda if there were a starving child standing next to the vending machine.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Everybody agrees that it's possible to be too selfish.
Is it possible to be too concerned with other people?
To say we ought to devote ourselves to caring for strangers far more than we do conflicts with something very, very deep.
Is there such a thing as too much altruism?
It is a far, far better thing that I do than I have ever done. It is a far, far better rest that I go to than I have ever known.
Oh, we can be heroes just for one day.
What would you give up to help a random stranger?
I think we can do a lot more than we think we can.
Our guest is Larissa McFarquhar, author of Strangers Drowning, grappling with impossible idealism, drastic choices, and the overpowering urge to help.
Extreme altruism. Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
In this season of giving, we want you to know that we're grateful to you, our listeners.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you for thinking.
And thank you for supporting Philosophy Talk.
All holding hands at midnight beneath the sorry sky. It's just nice work if you can get it, and you can get it if you try.
This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything
except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the Mars Theater in Berkeley, California.
Our thinking originates across the bay on the Stanford University campus. That's where Ken here teaches philosophy, and I did for 40 years. Although now I've seen the light, and I'm teaching in Berkeley.
You turncoat. We still kick your butt, though. Welcome, everyone, to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about extreme altruism.
Altruists, or altruists, are people willing to do good things for others at a cost to their own happiness and well-being.
Now, you know, John, some people think that humans are by nature completely self-interested. And, you know, of course, self-interest is the very opposite of altruism. But in fact, most of us have at least a touch of altruism in us.
Think of the parent who sacrifices her own well-being for the sake of her child. Some soldiers give up the comforts of home and hearth to fight in some distant desert. Some of them are surely driven by altruism, not by naked self-interest or their own happiness.
Indeed. You know, John, some evolutionary psychologists and biologists even argue that a tendency toward altruism, especially what's called in-group altruism, that's altruism toward kith and kin, is built into human beings from the very beginning by natural selection.
And it's not just the built-in results of biology and psychology that cause to some degree of altruism. Morality and religion clearly do so as well.
You know, clearly altruism is a good thing. Well, not necessarily for the individuals who practice it, but at least for the groups to which those individuals belong. But here's a question. Is it possible to take altruism too far? That's our question for today.
Well, I think it is. Think of someone who adopts as many needy children as they possibly can, and then is filled with regret that they can't do more.
Yeah, I don't know, John. I mean, people like that seem to me kind of saintly. And we admire saints, don't we?
Well, maybe, but I wouldn't want to live with one.
Oh, come on. Saints inspire us. They help us to honor the better angels of our nature. Why wouldn't you want to live with a saint?
Well, Ken, imagine what it would be like to be the child of a couple who felt an insatiable, saintly need to go on and save more children, every distressed children, everyone they can possibly find.
Well,
at some point you might be tempted to say, hey, Mom and Dad, can I have your attention for just a minute? Can we stop and be a normal family now so that we can have more things and do more things?
Oh, yeah, but but where do you draw the line if you start thinking like that?
What line?
The line between self-indulgence and duty. Look, I'm going to grant you, it's not okay to let your own children just starve so that you can feed other hungry children around the world. That's not okay.
Well, I'm glad you'll admit that.
Yeah, but isn't it just as wrong I mean, really, just as well, maybe more wrong, to overindulge your own children while entirely ignoring the needs of less fortunate strangers?
Well, what do you mean by overindulgence?
Well, come on, I'll give you an example. How can I justify buying my kids the latest hot toy, which they don't really need, when I could use that same money to buy food and clothes for dozens, I mean dozens of needy children in some rural third world village? Don't I have an obligation?
Well, I hate to get personal, Ken, but think of all the money you spent on helping your wonderful son become a better baseball player.
That was expensive.
All the good times you and he had together traveling to games, to tournaments, to showcases. Should you have given all that up so that you could have helped lots of children around the world?
Oh, jeepers, John. I wouldn't trade those experiences with my son for the world. I wouldn't trade them for anything.
And so what does that make you? A selfish schmuck? Or just a father who loves and cherishes his own son?
Oh, jeez, John. I guess I really do. I admire these extreme altruists. I really do. But I don't think I have what it takes to be one myself.
Well, me neither, but there are people who do have what it takes. And to get a feel for what they're like, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Shuka Kalantari, to find people who live in extreme devotion to the well-being of strangers. She files this report.
Sue Badeau is a social worker from Philadelphia. Sue has 22 children, 37 grandchildren, and 9 great-grandchildren. 20 of Sue's kids are adopted. Something she's always wanted to do.
I was about 11 or 12, and I read a book called The Family Nobody Wanted. This was about a family who had adopted children who were not babies, who were older children, who were from many different racial and ethnic backgrounds, who had disabilities. I just immediately fell in love with that whole family and said, that's the family I want to have.
After Sue gave birth to her first daughter, Chelsea, in 1980, she and her husband adopted a young boy who was abandoned during the war in El Salvador. After that, she gave birth to Isaac, her second and last biological child. Then, she and her husband adopted their son Raj from India.
Sort of our original overall game plan before we started even with any of them was, oh, you know, we'll have two and we'll adopt two. That was our life plan at the age of 20.
But things don't always go according to plan. In 1985, the family hopped into their car and took a road trip to an adoption agency in Albuquerque.
We adopted two sibling groups of children from New Mexico in the next few years after that trip.
3 decades later, Sue's first adopted son, Jose from El Salvador, now lives in Switzerland doing work in computer technology. He just had his first baby. But not all of Sue's kids have had great lives.
We did adopt 3 children with terminal illnesses, and they have all passed away. And that is, even when you know that's what you're getting into ahead of time, it's extremely difficult.
Another child is in prison, and there were many teen pregnancies. A lot of the time, Sue was discouraged, depressed, overwhelmed.
But when I look over the whole time frame with each child that's joined our family, they all have made astounding progress. We know we had a daughter we were told would never walk, and she became a dancer, and we had a son that we were told would never learn to read or write his name, and he graduated college.
Sue Badeau doesn't see anything extreme in her altruism. To her, adopting 20 kids is perfectly normal.
Someone who decides to climb Mount Everest and kind of sacrifice so much to do that. What in the world would you do that for? That's not something I would ever do. But we all have our passions, and if you follow your passion and you really live it, it may seem like it's extreme to others, and it may be normal to you.
Massachusetts resident Julia Wise agrees. She and her husband Jeff live off just 6% of their combined income so they can give the rest away to charity. It all started when Jeff bought Julia a candy apple at the fair one day.
And I realized that this sort of $3 or $4 that I had spent on, you know, something just fun for me was going to be money out of the hands of someone who really needed it a lot more than I did. I remember crying and, you know, Jeff getting pretty upset too and sort of wondering, how are we going to make this work? How are we going to have any kind of life if every minor decision, you know, is this big moral dilemma?
That was the beginning of a plan to give a set part of their income away to charity. Julia says that way, she didn't have to have a moral dilemma every time she bought a candy apple or went to the grocery store.
Everybody matters. You know, I matter and other people matter. And where we live in the world or whether we know each other doesn't affect how much people matter.
Julia and Jeff make a decent amount of money. In 2013, their combined income was about $245,000. That year, they lived off a little over $15,000. Julia says a lot of people, including her parents, think her altruism is rather extreme. But to her, it's normal. It's life.
Extremity is sort of in the eye of the beholder, and at this point, I don't see our lifestyle as extreme because it's working really well for us.
Sue Badeau adopted 20 children. Julia Wise gives away most of her income to charity. Is this your typical run-of-the-mill altruism? Not in the slightest. Is it extreme altruism? Not if you ask them. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Shuka Kalantari.
Thanks, Shuka, for letting us meet those extremely interesting and not very usual people. I'm John Perry. I'm here along with my fellow philosopher at Stanford, Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the Marsh Theater in Berkeley, California.
Our guest today is a staff writer at The New Yorker. She's author of a very fine book, Strangers Drowning, Grappling with Impossible Idealism, Drastic Choices, and the Overpowering Urge to Help. And I'll give you an overpowering recommendation to read this book. Please welcome to the Philosophy Talk stage, Larissa McFarquhar.
Larissa, you're a journalist by trade, very successful one, writing for probably the greatest magazine in the world. Not a professional philosopher. Many would call that a wise decision. but your book tackles a problem that has exercised a lot of philosophers, and it does so, if I may say so, in a rich and nuanced way. So how did a self-respecting journalist get so involved in such a philosophical mare's nest?
Well, you know, I've always admired saintly people, extreme altruists. I thought their lives were extraordinary, but I've been puzzled why we don't read more about them or hear more about them. And I think one of the reasons is that there's this misconception out there, which really irritates me, which is the idea that somehow while evil and evil people are fascinating and complex, that good people are simple and boring. And I had confirmation of this. I talked to a novelist at one point when I was writing my book. I said, why don't you novelists write more about these people? And he gave me this look of total contempt, as though I had asked him, why don't you write a nice book about bunnies and butterflies? And I thought, this is what I have to combat.
So you wrote a nice book, but nevertheless made it very interesting.
No bunnies.
So philosophers tend to make up examples, a noble art. Or use the same hackneyed ones over and over again. Maybe not so noble. But one of the refreshing things about your book is the real-life stories of real people whose lives are actually, and not hypothetically, devoted to extreme altruism. So when from your real experiences with these real people, what are they like and what drives them to live like that?
Well, you know, I hate to tell you because I would love to be able to say they are unlike us completely and therefore you don't need to worry about it. They're another species and it's not incumbent upon us to be saintly ourselves. Unfortunately, that's not true. They're just ordinary people with an extraordinary drive. As you heard from Sue, you know, while someone else might have a drive to climb Mount Everest, which the rest of us might find a little puzzling, they find in themselves a drive to be as moral as possible, but not for its own sake because they just think it's what a decent human being does. So just as you wouldn't pat yourself on the back for going into a store and emerging without stealing a single thing, so they don't think that what they're doing is special. They think, well, you know, if I give away a lot to charity, for instance, as we heard from Julia, she just thinks, well, I'm deciding that I'm not worth thousands and thousands of times more than somebody who is starving to death.
Wait a minute, though. I mean, I don't know what they think. About the rest of us, but I bet you if you took a survey of most people, most people would find what they do I don't know, why not call it odd, but not something most of us are moved to do. So, I mean, their psychology is different from ours in some way. I mean, and they may not be another species, but they're not us ordinary schmucks, right?
You know, I think it's more of an extreme version of what many of us feel anyhow. It's not completely different, because there's very few people who feel that they owe nothing to strangers, that they owe nothing to other people. And so it's just a matter of degree. So, for instance, Sue and Hector adopting 20 special needs kids, that's a lot. But they added them one after another after another. They didn't start out with a plan to adopt so many. And for them, it was just, each one of these kids was their children. And so it didn't seem abnormal to them.
This is Philosophy Talk, coming to you from the Mars Theater. Our guest is New Yorker writer Larissa Mefarquhar, and we're thinking about extreme altruism.
Extreme altruists are admirable people who do great good in the world. But what about those of us, or those of you, who are not similarly inclined? Does that make us self-centered schmucks free-riding on the righteousness of our moral superiors? Or is it morally okay to limit our altruism?
Extreme altruism and the demands of morality, along with questions from what I hope is a highly moral audience, when Philosophy Talk continues.
All of me. Oh, can't you see that I'm no good without you? Take both of these lips, I wanna lose them. Oh, why don't you take both of these arms? Don't think I'm ever gonna use them. Said your goodbyes left me with eyes that shine. How can I go on, darling, without you? I said you took the part of that once was my heart. Why not take all of me?
Thanks to our musical guest, Tin Cup Serenade. This is Philosophy Talk. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're thinking about extreme altruism. And our guest is Larissa Mefarquhar, author of Strangers Drowning.
How much altruism is the right amount? Surely there can be too little altruism, too much focus on the self and not enough on others. But can there be too much altruism, too much focus on others, and too little on oneself? Join the discussion by stepping up to the microphone in front of the stage.
So, okay, Larissa, morality clearly demands some degree of altruism of us, of all of us. We can't just thumb our nose at the needs of others and still be morally decent. But don't you think there is a limit to the amount of self-sacrifice demanded of us by morality?
You know, there is. And even if there weren't, the people I write about are successful do-gooders. I'm sure there are some who don't manage to work out a life of commitment, but they've succeeded, and the reason they have is that they've found limits to preserve their sanity, because if they gave away everything, there would be nothing left.
Right, but you said, see, I'm not sure what to make of these people. I mean, I think of them as living really far above and beyond the call of duty. It sounds like they don't think of themselves mm-hmm. that way. So here's my question. Are they morally deranged because they don't realize they're living above and beyond the call of duty? Or they're just more morally pure than, I mean, I'm not asking how they think of it. How should we think of them? As morally better than us because living above and beyond the duty, but going way beyond what we required, or morally deranged because they think that's what duty demands?
Well, you know, I'm sure there are some morally deranged people, for sure.
I don't
sure,
mean but evil.
These, but
I don't
these
mean
are
evil.
Not, no, I know what you mean. But, you know, I think we can do a lot more than we think we can. So take the family that adopted 20 special needs kids. That sounds like a crazy huge family, right? But the husband of that family grew up in a family of 16 biological kids. Now, you may also think that's crazy, but assuming it's not, you would never question the mother or father of 16 biological kids. Can you love all those kids? Are you capable of it? But somehow, because they're adopted, we think we can't do that. But I think they can. You know, this is not an orphanage they're running.
Okay. But again, it sounds like, so the philosophers have this category, some philosophers believe, not all, but some philosophers believe in this category of the supererogatory, that's morally good, but not morally required. The morally required is your duty. And there are other things beyond your duty that are morally good, but they're not morally required. These people seem to think, no, you guys who think the morally required lets you off the hook here. No, the morally required requires all this. I mean, that's how they think of it, right? That this stuff that they do is not just morally good and morally permissible, but morally required.
They do. And, you know, it seems to us now, I think, that to make any sense to us, a moral theory and what it demands has to allow that certain percentage of us, some percentage of us are decent people living decent lives. If a moral theory is so demanding that it makes all of us look like depraved sinners and psychopaths, it can't be right. But that's just us now. I mean, in medieval times, a theory that made all of us look like depraved sinners was perfectly normal. We were all assumed to be dreadful people living very, very sinful lives. Now that seems crazy to us, but it didn't always, and I'm not sure it is.
Let me ask a question here, maybe a little technical, but it seems when we talk about altruism, there's kind of two different patterns. The people who adopted a lot of children, they end up with a huge family, a much bigger family than usual, much bigger family than the normal course of biology would have given them. And we think of that as very altruistic. But there's another kind of altruism that says there's no difference between myself and those that are close to me and the rest of the world. Are those two different kind of psychological profiles? In other words, theoretical utilitarians like we find in philosophy sometimes can be taken to suggest that, no, it doesn't differ. I mean, you don't owe any more to your own child than you do to anybody else's child. So one thing is say, well, I include more people as my children. Maybe I include all the kids in California as my children, like Senator and Mrs. Stanford did. But still, they thought they owed more to the children of California than they owed to the children of, say, Massachusetts. So are those two different kinds of people and two different kinds of altruism?
You know, I think it's a matter of degree, because I think it would be a pretty rare person to feel that he owed nothing to anyone other than his immediate nuclear family. And indeed, you know, as you know, the whole idea of the nuclear family being the core of your duty is pretty new. I mean, it used to be a larger group composed of aunts and cousins and uncles and, you know, what have you, and perhaps your village and perhaps your, you know, the people who are of the same religion as you or your same community. And I think it doesn't seem to me as though they're two fundamentally different types, because, you know, take that picture that everyone in the world saw of that poor toddler drowning off the coast of Greece, right? For that moment, most of us need visual aids. For that moment, when you saw that photograph, many people had the same reaction. He seemed, that little toddler, like someone who mattered to us. Not as much as our own children, obviously, but as much as like a child drowning over there nearby, because we could see him. He, because of technology now, I think what would have been totally removed strangers in other parts of the world can seem to us, if only temporarily, like people in our community. So I don't think it's quite as strange as it used to be to feel strongly about those people.
Right, but okay, I want to speak on the, so utilitarians think, I count, those near and dear count, but those near and dear count no more, no less than those at a distance, right? The distance doesn't really matter to how much they count morally. And the utilitarian says you should always try to be doing the greatest good for the greatest number. Don't lavish goods on yourself or this person when you could do much greater. I mean, for the Peter Singer loves to say, for that $75 bottle of wine you have for the dinner, right? If you save that up over a year even, you could bring potable water to a village serving 5,000 in Africa. So do that.
Or you could have 7 bottles of $10 wine.
Well, whatever.
Also very important.
Okay, I get the point. I get the argument. But here's the thing I don't get. Think your extreme altruists see. I think the particular people who are close to me, who are near and dear to me, they do matter in a special way. And I think human beings are made to want to matter to one another in what I call an up-close and personal way. If I have a kid, he's not just one person among others. He's or she is my responsibility. Because focused parental love and nurturing that knows the ins and outs of your life and can help you manage that life and grow into a moral agent and an autonomous, self-governing person, that's really important. And human beings aren't just abstracta on some utilitarian calculus. What would your extreme altruists say about that?
They would completely agree with you. It's just a matter of degree. So, you know, as you know, I mean, even most utilitarians don't really believe that one child of mine is worth exactly this. I should consider him exactly the same as a child on the other side of the earth. So how much more should I consider my child? You might say I should spend 50% of my time with that child. But you wouldn't say I should spend 100% of my time with that child, because you have other things that you want to do with your time. I mean, I'm sorry, I'm sure your son is really charming, but I imagine that sometimes you want to leave and just go read.
Well, he's off at college now, thank God.
Oh, okay, there you go. So you're evading the question. But, you know, you might feel that you owe him a good education. You might feel that you owe him a certain percentage of your time, but do you feel that you should spend every cent of your money on indulging his every whim?
Of course not.
And not
he'd be a monster.
Well, exactly. It wouldn't even be good for him. So I think we all agree that you owe something to your family and something to strangers. And the question is figuring out the proportions. And obviously the people I have been writing about and meeting think the proportions are rather different.
See,
from
you,
most of
see
us.
So you, I know you read, one of the things that got started on you on this was Susan Wolf's article on what's called Moral Saints.
Yeah.
And she argues that these people are really not us. They're human, but they're not really the kind of humans we all strive to be, and that trying to be one would undermine self, all kinds of things. And there's much more to life than morality. And these people are like monomaniacal about morality. And she doesn't seem to admire them. You think that's the wrong... It sounds like you actually admire these moral saints and want there to be more of them, and not like Susan Wolf saying, yuck. She didn't quite say yuck to them, but she...
Well, she kind of did.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, she made such a... it was such a challenge to... And that's part of what I wanted to do in this book, is to meet that challenge. Because she said, you know, a morally perfect person would be so unpleasant. We wouldn't want to be with that person at all.
Unbearable to be around.
Unbearable. No sense of humor, no interests other than helping constantly. It would be a real drag to be around that person. But I thought, okay, this is a philosophical abstraction. What are real people like? And are they really that bad? And it turns out, no surprise, I don't think so. So for instance, even these fairly consistent utilitarians that I write about, Jeff and Julia, whom you heard about earlier, you know, it's pretty lucky for Jeff and Julia that the things that they love to do in life, they do have lots of loves in life other than helping others, they just happen to be really cheap. So, you know, they don't love to go on like world cruises or $75 bottles of wine. They don't even really like to drink. What they really like is Julia loves to make toys for her baby. She has a baby out of little old scraps, or she likes to make hats for herself out of scraps she finds in the garbage. And like, you know, she's kind of, she's a little bit like a pioneer woman.
So Jeff is her husband?
Yeah.
Jeff is her husband.
He was the one who was really annoyed because she didn't want the
candy apple.
Oh, no,
well,
he bought it. No, but Jeff is even more psychologically equipped for this life because he never spends money on anything at all.
Oh, well, see,
doesn't have
before
to
desire. Before you told me
that,
I was going to say he's the one that sounds like a saint.
Well, she chose, you know,
putting up with someone whose hobby is making hats out of garbage.
No, they're beautiful hats. You should go on her blog. They're great hats. They're these beautiful Easter bonnets. You can make a lot with garbage. And the key, obviously, as you've perceived, is that if you're going to be a do-gooder, it's really important who you marry.
Yeah, I guess
really
so.
Important.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about extreme altruism in front of a live audience at the Mars Theater, and we've got a question from that audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you. My name is Greg, and I'm from Berkeley. I guess my question has to do with what constitutes self-sacrifice. And in the example of the couple that adopted many, many children, it seemed to me, and I think she even expressed it, that this was something that she believed in and as being important for a very long time. And so I would say that in her case, she led a very authentic life, in a sense that what she did expressed the values that she had. And so in that sense, the sacrifice to her wasn't that great because it still was expressive of the things that she valued. On the other hand, if you consider someone whose values are very, very different than this woman's, and who nonetheless thought that, you know, I had to adopt many, many children, I had to do all these things, and have to give up all these other aspirations and dreams that I have, let's say, as an aspiring artist. In that case, I have to give up what is socially valuable, deeply meaningful to me, and that would constitute, I think, a certain kind of self-sacrifice that is quite considerable, and I would say probably morality wouldn't demand that kind of behavior.
Right. I mean, I think that's an excellent question. This life of extreme altruism, what we think of as extreme altruism, is a self-chosen life. It's a self-generated life from values that I hold. I mean, if you happen to value the well-being of others to this degree that you will devote your life to it, that's not like morality demanding of you. That's your choosing. So they're kind of under the illusion that this is mandatory rather than discretionary. That's their problem. Well, I mean, following on that question, right? Well, it wouldn't be mandatory for the artist.
You're right? Saying that's what the problem of the irritating altruist
right.
is.
Right, yeah.
But there may be lots of altruists who think that what they're doing is supererogatory
right,
and other
exactly.
people are perfectly fine.
Exactly.
So
right.
we're talking about the irritating
right.
altruists.
Right, that person wouldn't be holding it over the rest of us as a club, wouldn't be saying, this is what everybody wants to
do. Or the ones that irritate you. No one really irritates me.
Yeah. So I'm just wondering what you...
Well, you know, it's true that the people who I've met are not living miserable, bleak lives. They're living happy lives because... You know, while they do give up the $75 bottle of wine, first of all, it's true, they are, on the whole, people who aren't that interested in $75 bottles of wine, but also they have something so much more pleasurable than that. They feel that they're living their lives the way they ought to, which is something that very few of us, certainly not me, can feel and say. And that gets you past a lot of given up meals out in restaurants, I think.
So just a short question, because we're going to have to take a break. What percentage of the extreme altruists that you got to know and interviewed, was this based on some kind of religious or transcendental principle as opposed to just what came naturally to them or at least came from the inside, so to speak?
Of the ones I spoke to, it was about 50-50, but I don't think that's necessarily true of the population at large. I mean, it's at small, I should say, because there are very few of these people. But there is a difference, not in degree of commitment, but you know, the people who are religious feel, most of them, that ultimately the well-being of the world is God's business, and it's up to him. And the atheists feel, you know, we're alone here. Mm. There's no God that's going to come fix things. If we don't do it, no one's going to.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're thinking about extreme altruism with Larissa McFarquhar, author of Strangers Drowning.
In our final segment, we'll ask what it would be like to live with an extreme altruist.
We're coming to you from the Mars Theater in Berkeley. We'll take more questions from our highly altruistic audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Thank you.
Oh, when the saints go marching in. Oh, when the saints go marching in. Lord, I want to be in that number. Yeah. Oh, when the saints go marching in. Oh, when the sun refuses to shine. Oh, when the sun refuses to shine. Lord, I want to be in that number. Oh, when the saints go marching in.
Thanks to our live musical guest, Tin Cup Serenade. I'm John Perry. I think you were clapping for Tin Cup Serenade, so I'll repeat. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We're thinking about extreme altruism with author and New Yorker staff writer Larissa McFarquhar. And we got a question from our audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hi, I'm Chris from Oakland. I read your book and I had a question about your conception of effective altruism. You say that effective altruists keep running up against the problem of people's irrationality, that it's very easy to get people to give more money if they're moved emotionally, but it's very hard to get them to, committed philanthropists, to give money to causes that they're not as invested in. But at the same time, the point of effective altruism is that it's to do the most good for the most people for the least money, and it's not important who's doing the helping. So I was wondering if you thought effective altruists might be more effective by getting, ultimately more effective as a group, by getting more people to give more money, by being more accommodating and yielding to the concerns of potential givers. Because as I was reading your book, I got the sense that effective altruism was as much about championing rationalism as it seemed to be about helping others.
You know, that's a really good point. And actually, Julia, whom we've been talking about, thinks about this a great deal, because she does feel that the effective altruist movement, such as it is pretty dominated by young, technically minded men who do tend to speak in a somewhat alienating, rational fashion that doesn't really get to the reason that most people give money, which is a sense of empathy, a sense of compassion. And she wants to figure out how best to appeal to empathy, but without leaving things the way they are. I mean, there's a interesting psychologist at Yale, Paul Bloom, who's working on a book called Against Empathy. And that's, you know, it's a little tongue-in-cheek. He's not against all empathy. But what he wants to communicate, and this is something that effective altruists want to communicate too, is sometimes empathy, which we think of as just this unadulteratedly lovely, sweet, good thing, can be just the warm and fuzzy face of bigotry. Because right. We feel empathy towards people who are like us.
Tell our listeners what you mean by effective altruism. That's a little different from extreme altruism. It's related.
Yeah. Effective altruists are basically utilitarians of the Peter Singer stripe. The effective part is that they think we should stop giving for sentimental reasons, and we should do a lot of research to figure out which charities, as you said, relieve the most suffering for the least money. And the altruism part is they all think it's incumbent upon us to give much more than we do. I think to join certain branches of the movement, you have to commit to giving 10% of your income for the rest of your life, but many of them give much more than that.
So I want to put a challenge to you. Suppose you were one of these extreme altruists, either the effective altruist type or some other type. I said to you, you know what? You're just being a sucker. The world is morally imperfect. The world is radically morally imperfect. Suppose everybody about you was a lying, cheating son of a gun, right? And morality says to you, don't lie, don't cheat, don't be a son of a gun. Everybody about you is a lying, cheating son of a gun. This is morality saying to you, be a sucker. That's called non-ideal circumstances, right? Some people think that in non-ideal circumstances, morality kind of goes silent because it doesn't really provide you guidance, since you can't on your own perfect the world and any steps you take might just be wasted. What if I said that to either an effective altruist or an extreme altruist? You're just being a sucker, and I'm not going to be a sucker. If everybody were to chip in and do their part, yeah, but I'm not going to take on the rest of the world's non-complying part.
Well, you know, if you said it to a biologist, what they might say is, you know, we basically do assume that humans are cheating, lying, son of a guns, and how, therefore, do we explain these few people who aren't? And it doesn't make any sense, and they do look like suckers on first glance. They would explain it as, well, you are, if you're that kind of person, a lying cheater is going to look at you and say, I'm going to work with that person.
Well, right.
Because they're going to help me out.
Well, right. Well, if they were a biologist, they'd say, look, if you only had one shot, right, or game theorist, if you only had one shot with that person, well, then you never, the lying cheater is going to win every time. But if it's an iterated game and you can
Which
play
it
over and over
right.
again, and life is an iterated game, so,
right.
you know, some of the cheaters sometimes get weeded out. But still, the world is radically morally imperfect. And if the moral command is perfect the world, I can't do that.
But that's not the moral command. I mean, at least with the people, you know, this is why maybe I'm a journalist and not a philosopher, is because the people I'm writing about are not, they don't think about perfection, they don't think about purity, they don't think in theoretical terms much at all. They think about relieving suffering, and that's a business of a little bit at a time.
Yeah.
They do what they can, and they know that they're not going to change the world. And I think, you know, one of the ways we get ourselves off the hook, the rest of us decadent, depraved people like myself, they say, well, we can't possibly fix the world. It's futile. It's hopeless. So I'm not even going to bother. That's the step that they don't take. They say, you know, I can't fix the world. I'm just one person, but I can do a little bit. And if I'm not so pompous as to think that's not good enough for me, I'm going to do that.
I just want to, there seems to be a big difference between what you're calling effective altruists and what we might call emotional or affective altruists. There's people like, imagine these this couple adopted so many kids to be, who just find, you know, nowadays it's common to just have one, two, or three children. We're obviously capable of dealing with a great many more. And for some people, when you see a child that's not yours, that's needy, it's just natural if you got the time. And you can, I'm sure Ken, when he coached his son's baseball team, found that, yeah, it's fine to spend a lot of time coaching my son, but these are, you're just naturally drawn to help these other kids. And so it seems to me some kind of altruists are just following their natural instincts and realizing that the main thing interesting about them is what they can do for others. Then this idea of, you know, saving the world, making the world perfect, going at it with these rational techniques and figuring out, you know, which little town in the world and which group is the best one for me to donate to. That may make a lot of sense too, but to me that's a completely different instinct.
Do you know what? I think this actually, I think you pinpointed a way in which at least the people I spoke to are different from us, because I came to feel that they had an almost aesthetic quality that was different. They have a vividness of imagination that most of us don't. So most of us require that visual stimulus, like the photograph we were talking about mm-hmm. of the toddler drowning, or the sight of someone in front of you, the sight of another kid on your son's baseball team who needs help, and you go out to help him because you see him and you see his need. These people don't need that visual stimulus. They know, as we all know in theory, that there are people out there who need our help, but they can feel it. They can feel it vividly and urgently in the way that we do if we see it ourselves. And so one guy I wrote about said, you know, nobody would buy a soda if there were a starving child standing next to the vending machine. Well, for me, there always is a starving child standing next to the vending machine. He can almost see that child.
It's, like that.
It's a power of imagination that most of us don't have and are glad we don't have, because it's difficult.
It's like that movie, The Sixth Sense, where that little kid says, I see dead people everywhere. It's like, I see needy people.
It's only dying people, yeah.
Yeah, I see needy people everywhere. Welcome to Philosophy Talk. What's your comment or question?
Thank you. My name's Rebecca. I'm from Else Bronte. And my question has to do with society's role in developing an altruistic person. And is this something that we see much more greed in our society because it's very revered? We see politicians and we see it everywhere, this level of greed, and it's looked up to in a way. Or if we saw the altruistic person more reflected in the media, or if we saw our neighbors doing altruistic things and revered that at a high place, if people would be influenced by that. And I wondered, in your case studies, if these people's communities or friends were repelled by what they were doing, or if they were inspired by it, and if in your studies, if you've seen how people are affected by the seeing the deeds of others that are close to them, rather than having it be Mother Teresa, but their neighbor or their friend or their family.
Yeah, I mean, certainly the people I've written about have encountered a lot of, at best, skepticism and at worst, hostility from the people around them. People think they're very weird. People don't understand what they're doing. And some people think what they're doing is actively pernicious. I mean, to take, for example, Sue and Hector Badeau, who adopted the 20 kids, many people feel that that was the wrong thing to do. That who do they think they are? That they can imagine they could be parents to so many. And I think they did an extraordinary job. And fortunately for those children, they decided to ignore those people. But they had a lot of pushback.
So Susan Wolf, she gets most of our reaction to these moral saints, right. But you think, not that you think everybody should be a moral saint, but you think it's really good that there are these moral saints among us. But they're not really, I mean, why don't we take them as exemplars?
You know, I think some of it is petty stuff. Like, you know, we don't like to, it's irritating to be made to feel guilty. It's irritating to feel that someone, even if only implicitly, is telling us that we're living our lives the wrong way. But also, I think there's something deeper, and that's what we were talking about earlier, which is many people are genuinely unsure whether it's the right thing to care so much for strangers that they don't give everything they want to their children and their family. I mean, for most people, they want to give everything they possibly can to the people they love. And not only do they want to do that, they think that's the right thing to do. So to say we ought to be more moral, we ought to devote ourselves to caring for strangers far more than we do, conflicts with something very, very deep that is not petty at all.
Yeah, so this is complicated stuff. I wish we were just kind of scratching the surface. We could talk about this for hours. But unfortunately, we don't have hours on the radio. And I'm going to have to thank you for joining us, Larissa.
Thank you so much.
Our guest has been Larissa McFarquhar. She's a staff writer at The New Yorker. She's author of Strangers Drowning, Grappling with Impossible Idealism, Drastic Choices, and the Overpowering Urge to Help. And I got to say, this is one of the most fascinating books I have read. The storytelling is amazing. The philosophy is deep. I cannot think of another book that brings all these things together like this. So you really should read this book.
And buy it, too.
Yeah.
John, because she's probably sending all her royalties, too.
Yeah, well, right. We didn't ask her about that.
Yeah.
So, John, what's your... Are you having... You want to go out and save the world now?
I've always wanted to, but...
You're actually a very altruistic person.
Yeah. So, the problem... I mean, take Singer and the drowning child. And there's a bit... I don't know if it's a paradox, but if you're convinced, if somebody comes, Peter Singer's, I make him a lot of convinced, he said, well, if it's worth your time and your suit and so forth to save that drowning child, then if you're consistent, if you're logically consistent, you'll be willing to put just endless increments of time into saving other kids around. Or if he convinces you of that if-then statement, then you can do the contrapartite and say, well, actually, it's pretty clear to me that it makes no sense for me to invest any time at all in saving kids, you know, in India and Africa, and for that matter, conscious beings in Alpha Centauri, if I could. Therefore, thanks, Peter. It really doesn't make much sense for me to stop and save this kid either. So there's that back and forth, and you might think our natural morality is kind of...
Yeah. But he starts from the givenness, the indisputability that you should save that child. So, I don't know. I don't think morality requires you to perfect the world all on your own. I think it calls on us jointly, and if everybody else isn't doing their part, I don't know what follows for you. But you know what? This conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner, at our online community of thinkers, where our motto is cogito ergo blogo. I think, therefore I blog. And you too can become a partner in that community just by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org.
Now let's hear from a man who altruistically devotes his life to speed. It's Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, in the U.S., giving unto others is seen as a sucker's game. There is a Christian element to our giving vein, but it is tempered by a gut feeling that the poor might be getting away with something. We talk of the deserving poor. We put constant constraints and welfare recipients. You aren't on drugs, are you? Take this test. You can get these things with your food stamps, but not these. Stand in that special line to use your food stamps so we other customers who have credit cards don't have to be stuck behind you and can cluck our tongues at your poverty, which is probably your own fault. My favorite story of this way judgy element to our giving came from the Washington Post. It has a feature called Inspired Life, what we used to call back when Paul Harvey walked the earth, human interest stories. The twin pillars of journalism are human interest stories and scandals. If you can combine the two, you have the holy grail of clickbait. Inspired Life has had stories about a Good Samaritan who helped dig out snowbound motorists, a girl named Isis who defended herself from classmates who thought she was a terrorist, apparently, and a story last Christmas about Up TV, a startup channel devoted to uplifting stories. It was a feel-good story about feel-good stories, like a snake devouring its tail in a nice way. Up TV did a show about low-income children. Up TV asked the kids what they wanted for Christmas and what their parents wanted. Then they brought out the cornucopia of dream gifts, Xboxes and Barbie dream houses for the kids, a ring or a watch for the parents. Then the kids were told they could only pick one, their gift or the parents. How heartwarming is that? Well, the kids picked the gifts for the parents, see, and the kindly folks at Up TV, touched by the selflessness displayed by their creepy social experiment, let them keep both. Someday, of course, the poor may take the NRA to heart, pick up guns, and grab it all before it's even offered. In a more recent incident of armed altruism, Robert Finnecombe, the now-deceased spokesman for the Oregon militia, the ones occupying the bird sanctuary in the name of freedom, told Oregon Public Broadcasting that the four foster children living on his ranch in Arizona had been taken away by the feds. Finnecombe told OPB, quote, "That was my main source of income. My ranch, well, the cows just covered the cost of the ranch," unquote. According to a 2010 tax filing, Catholic Charities had paid Finnecombe just over $115,000 to foster children in 2009. Now, if you can't keep your ranch going by grazing on federal lands and harboring orphans, what is the world coming to? Recent events in Flint, Michigan may have some bearing on altruism as well. As I understand it, Flint water became poisoned because elected officials were replaced with emergency managers who decided basically that the city just did not have the money to pay for clean drinking water. Potability doesn't grow on trees, people. But why were the poor whining so much about it? Did they even deserve lead-free water? How thirsty can they be if they don't even have jobs to work up a thirst? Shirkers. Maybe we should pay militia ranchers to adopt Flint for a couple months, make the poor saddle old paint at gunpoint. Until then, let them eat cake or drink bottled water. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2016.
Our executive producer is David Demarest. Special thanks to Stephanie Wiseman, Nicole Pena, Orgel Zal, Dan Brandon, and Crystal Nickerson.
Thanks also to our musical guests, Rolf Wilkinson, Safa Shokrai, and Larry Light, Tin Cup Serenade.
The program is produced by Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Our marketing director is Dave Millar.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and from the partners at our online community of thinkers.
And from the members of KALW, Local Public Radio San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking. Bop.